The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's June 19th, 2024. It's 2:37 in the afternoon and high. This is John Williams. You're listening to the Mincing Rascals podcast. We'll broadcast portions of this Saturday night at 8 on WGN Radio, and you can listen to me weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
I am Marge Halperin. Years of experience as a journalist, working in government reform as a communications consultant and a community activist, doing what I can to challenge authority.
Hey guys, Brandon Pope here, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago, contributor to a number of different media organizations, and unfortunately, working on Juneteenth.
That is today.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now writing the Chicago History Substack, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Austin Bird from the Illinois Policy Institute. You can buy my book, The New Chicago Way. And you can hire my marketing agency, which I never talk about, Iron Light, if you need marketing.
Iron Light, ooh. L-I-G-H-T, Iron Light.
L-I-G-H-T. We got 28 people full-time across the country. We've helped change 70 laws.
Oh, wow.
That's probably what I spend half my time on, but my other half I spend on all the Chicago and Illinois stuff.
Y'all hiring?
Yeah, man. I would love to get Pope. We just got some audio work. I will text you about that.
I love a good side gig. Let's get it.
All right.
By the way,
he says this podcast doesn't achieve results.
Yeah, right. Well, it doesn't pay. I know that. But you guys were very generous with your time when you joined us at the Winter's Jazz Club last Wednesday. And for those of you who were able to catch us in person, the event sold out. But we had a really good time. And last week's podcast sounded a little different than this one right now because we were in front of a live studio audience. And we moved along swiftly, but I thought that was a really fun conversation. And then it was like a happy hour afterwards. We have to do our podcast where you can have a cocktail. I thought that was a really fun day, and it was really nice to meet your families, too. Did you guys have a good time?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to be in person. I agree totally. And to see the families that were there, whether they were our own or others, is fun to see the folks who are paying attention to what we say.
Well, that's
it was so much fun. Yeah. And I mean, you guys, I think, all do this kind of thing. And I had never been on a stage since the last time I graduated from something. So I was kind of like,
thank you to the listeners. There was someone who came up and said, say thanks to your wife for being a great teacher.
And
I was
like,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
There's a guy who read my book who came up, who was really friendly. So thank you to all the listeners who came.
Yeah, it was really cool. I was really thankful to talk to everybody. Thanks for everyone that came out. And it's great to hear folks really enjoy the podcast and be a part of it. There's no podcast without y'all. So thanks for listening.
Well, the thing is, too, you never know who's out there. Like, we're all on a Zoom. We see each other, but we don't see the listeners. And when they all showed up, I went, all right, I can deal with this. These are cool. These are good, cool, smart people. So thank you for being the listener to the podcast for people who care about Chicago. And Chicagoans are just going to love this one. Mayor Brandon Johnson has signed an executive order launching a reparations task force. Over 12 months and $500,000, the city will examine options, which may or may not include cash payments. Alderman Jason Irvin told us that it might come in the form of scholarships or job training programs or investments in neighborhoods. He stressed the word investment, as the idea is less, he said, about compensating people. It's more about empowering people who have been disenfranchised. How do people react when they hear reparations? And is this something the city should be pursuing?
To answer your last question, I certainly think yes. I love that description from Alderman Irvin, because I think that is the deeper work. I think people's reaction, to answer that part of your question, generally is, or we're going to be handing out cash to people, you know, and they want to debate who deserves the cash and who doesn't. But if you look at that big picture, the way that he stated it and the way the mayor stated it, the way his new chief equity officer, Carla Coupe, is stating it, it makes a lot of sense. And it's about rebuilding the city in the ways that we've been talking about doing for decades, you know. Like one of the things that she did, Coupe was part of the Inspector General's office, and she created plans specific to departments. The one example I read probably isn't the best example, but it's a good one. She created a plan so that the Department of Cultural Affairs would commit $6 million to community artists. Cultural Affairs has always given arts grants, been doing that since it was founded in the Harold Washington days, to build up arts. But focusing on community artists is the way to offer some equity through the arts. What are the ways to do it? Through housing, through education. And I know we're going to talk about the CTU's ideas for that in a couple of minutes, but they have some also. Neighborhood building, taking care of the vacant lots, providing opportunities and jobs where they're needed. Every statistic that comes out for this city, whether it's healthcare or jobs or the COVID rates or all these other things, show that people of color have less access to city services and have less opportunity and less knowledge or take less advantage of them. And this is a major correction that we need across the country. And I love that Chicago wants to be a leader in that.
One of the statistics that jumped out at me this week was that the average white Chicago family's net worth is about $200,000, assets minus liabilities. The average black person in Chicago's net worth is zero. They zero out. They actually have zero wealth, if you will, accumulated just because of things like healthcare costs. One third of black Chicagoans carry considerable medical debt, among other things. So there is inequity out there, but people bristle, Brandon, when they hear about reparations. Are you surprised to hear that?
No, I'm not surprised that people bristle. I think especially, I think this is, it's great to see a major city take this step. And I think that it's great to see one take a step with actual details about how they could actually make it work. Lori Lightfoot introduced a similar thing, but did not really have a process for implementation. And she had a committee that met 2 days out of the year, and we heard nothing else about it. Whereas Johnson set clear benchmarks here, 90 days, get a report out to people, public hearings, public forums, and looking to explore different avenues for reparations that go beyond just cash payments. And I think when people hear reparations, they think cash payments. But if you take the Evanston model, the first city in the U.S. to actually implement reparations, they did it through housing. They understood that redlining was a big issue in their community, and they said, let's do something with mortgages, do something with housing values, and help folks directly there. You know, I think it'd be interesting to see what Chicago can come up with that could be creative and help solve some inequities there. But no, I'm not surprised at the backlash or white lash. Often it's white lash because we're in this era of an anti-DEI post-George Floyd wave where folks, frankly, don't have an appetite for the things they claim they had an appetite for in the height of 2020, and that is correcting systemic wrongs. Ultimately, we got to see what the numbers look like. Got to see what the charge to taxpayers is going to be like. Mm-hmm. I can understand concerns when it comes to that. But I think any opportunity we have to reset the scales and help balance things out for and make sure more people have opportunity in a city, I think it's a good thing.
It was inevitable once Evanston got the ball rolling. So I'm surprised that anyone's surprised that we're funding this study of it.
I don't think they're surprised, something. Kate. I think some people are just, I don't think people are surprised that we're doing it, but that doesn't mean they like it. They endorse it.
And then we got other stuff to worry about, which is,
Yeah.
And how do you fund it?
I'm very interested to see what they come up with. I do default on favoring seeing programs not being defined by race, but by socioeconomic metrics. Legally, we're better off doing that. Also, there's obviously more buy-in for that. It's going to get you to the same place in some place like Chicago. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. It's so not a big
best Southwest, yeah, right. For instance, is something that would probably be included in this program, but it wasn't called reparations. And it doesn't need to have that title over it to do that work. The problem there kind of goes both ways, though, because there are a certain contingent of pro-reparations people who look down upon programs that they see as piecemeal and not really counting as reparations, and that would include something like Southwest. And then you have people who don't like it if you do put that title on it. So it kind of goes both ways.
Sounds like they aren't concerned about the genealogy of the individuals, which is interesting, because were you necessarily related to someone who was brought over on a slave ship? The alderman said, that doesn't matter. It's the color of your skin. That's the lasting legacy of this thing. That's where the discrimination lies. I had not heard of the word white lash before. Did you invent that, or is that in the black community? And I'm unawares, Brandon.
It's a growing term in the white community. I'm sorry, in the black community.
About the white community. Yeah.
About what we've seen recently. There's been a lot of this anti-DEI wave and attacks on wokeness, quote unquote, and all mm-hmm. that type of stuff. It definitely feels like the election of Donald Trump after Barack Obama, it all felt like a big white lash, not really a backlash, meaning powered by white grievance and racial animus.
Austin, usually. Would you get behind something like this?
It all depends about what the details are. And I think that's what's often difficult about reparation. So Evanston is a very specific program to Evanston, where there is sort of a genealogical component, and you have to prove that you had ancestors who were in Evanston at the time that there was housing discrimination going on a racial basis. So it's sort of narrowly tailored. But even that's facing legal challenges that I think have a pretty good odds of being successful. So I think Kate is right that if you do things like just cut checks based on race, you're going to have really big constitutional and legal problems with that. So they should be, people discussing this should be aware of that, I think. And of course, Chicago has a horrible legacy of race-based discrimination against Black Chicagoans. I mean, you look at where our highway system was built. Like, it's like physically built into the sort of physical city in many ways. And of course, redlining as well in the city of Chicago. What I worry about with efforts like this is that oftentimes they're sort of painting over those scars, and rather than doing what I think is most beneficial for the people most harmed, which is to create a city that has incredible thriving opportunities for everyone and incredible thriving opportunities for Black Chicagoans. You can do that by thinking about the ways that we have redlining today. We have redlining in our school system today in the city of Chicago. You have to go to school based on where you live, based on your zip code. If you're rich, you move to a richer zip code and you go to a better school, right? So I think school choice fights against educational redlining, and it has done so in cities like Milwaukee. You have, in a sense, redlining in the public safety system, where, you know, there's horrific public safety outcomes in many Black neighborhoods in the city of Chicago. And it would be better served if we focused our attention not necessarily on like cutting a one-time check if you're Black, but fixing our police department. And
everybody would benefit from that. Okay, but that's the problem too.
Especially Black Chicagoans.
I think that's also part of the problem. I suspect that the people that are hoping for reparations want it to be race specific. If everybody benefits from a safer Chicago or a healthier Chicago,
it's disparate outcomes in the school system disparately harm Black Chicagoans. Disparate outcomes in public safety disparately harm Black Chicagoans. So when you fix those things, yes, there are residual benefits to everybody, but they disproportionately benefit the people who are hurting the most. So I think race is often, it can tell us a lot, but at the end of the day, it's often an imprecise and obfuscating factor when we talk about actually fixing the city. So I just think it's really important to think about, like, to the mayor's point, like, root causes. Look at the school system, look at the police system, rather than just, hey, if you're Black, you get this. I just think that's imprecise and probably won't fix a lot of the underlying problems in the city.
I think that's where they're going exactly. When they talk about programs that benefit the communities that have been harmed in the past, we all benefit. They talk about improving housing or schools, policing for sure. The people who are most unsafe when they interact with police are people of color. There's no doubt about that. The majority of students in the underperforming schools are people of color. I met a young man campaigning recently in Austin who said his family is stuck in their family home, which is paid for because they've had generations in this home, but it's worthless. And it's dangerous. So their children can't go out safely in the street, and yet they can't sell their house. They can't buy another house. They're stuck. It like almost goes back to the 40 acres and a mule. We've been promising this community equity since the Civil War. And here in Chicago, we have done quite the opposite.
See, I think the other challenge here, and part of the what's going to be a tough hurdle to climb, I don't think it should be up to municipalities and cities to do reparations for what has been a largely American writ large problem. I think it should be on the federal government. Now, asking the federal government to do anything is a big ask in itself. But that I think having cities do reparations packages gets tricky, when especially when you're attaching it to the legacy of slavery. That is a uniquely, specifically American issue that I believe the American government itself and the institution of America should have to answer for, not just if you live in Chicago, you get to benefit from this. Because what about the other folks? You could argue folks that are in the South who are descendants in Texas, who have been, their family's legacy is in Texas. You could argue they are more deeply impacted by that legacy of slavery than those who were, you know, part of the Great Migration and came to Chicago or Gary or things like that in the North.
The surface level concern that I brought up was really brought about by the fact that you had, in the same week of the reparations sort of announcement, the big press push from the mayor's office was about how we are, we believe, the blackest administration in history. And we need to get to the point where we're like, so what? So you're the blackest administration in history. But does that help the person who is living in Austin and is in generational poverty and their house is worthless? Does it really? Maybe it's a leading indicator. Maybe it's to say, now that we have the blackest administration in history, now we can actually address some of these things. But it's really not an outcome that is affecting the lives of Black Chicagoans who have been here for generations dealing with those things. So I think some of the backlash is related to that, where it's like, mm-hmm. Hey, this, no one was asking, like, this was not even in the top 20 things on my list of, like, things we got to fix about the city.
I could agree there. There's a lot of other things I'd like to get worked on. Fix the CTA, you know, things like that.
But it's the promise, the implication is the promise that you said, Austin, that these will be people with the lived experiences and the embedded in the communities that need this help. I don't know if that's true, but I sort of think an announcement like that just reminds me of how Johnson doesn't understand what I consider to be a number one rule of government, which is under promise, over deliver. And by putting this out as so there, we're fixing things, I fix them and then show us and we'll understand how the team you put together is responsible for the results that we needed. But to announce that now I have the people who could deal with the things that have never been fixed before you fix them, I don't think that's a helpful announcement. I wouldn't write that press release.
Speaking of things that might be promised and need to be fixed, the CPS and CTU held a two-hour live stream contract negotiation, air quotes around negotiation, last week. It seemed to be a little pro forma to me, each side laying out their broader position and agreeing that things like we need greener air-conditioned schools, that's a good idea. I do like the idea of watching legislation being debated, or Supreme Court justices deliberating, or at least hearing arguments, or court cases being televised. I think Trump's trial should be televised. But how much of the give and take of a negotiation like this should the public see? Austin, you said you did watch that two-hour special because it was a Friday night and evidently the bars were closed. So what was that like between 5 and 7 p.m. on Friday, Austin?
I didn't watch it live.
Was better. Good answer.
But so I think in the case of this sort of one-off, quote-unquote, transparent bargaining session, it's very much a kayfabe, which is the term in wrestling where it's sort of a staged theatrical production. This is not an actual bargaining session in any way. Everything is planned in advance. The talking points are laid out. Yeah. It's like a congressional hearing in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's actually like more staged than that, I think. in many ways. So, but the CTU really, and Brandon Johnson loves saying this term, like, we're doing this in the front yard, like everybody's going to see these bargaining sessions. But the thing that strikes me is you have the district that's facing a $400 million deficit next year, assuming nothing changes. That's assuming no raises, everything's frozen, no costs go up. And one demand from the CTU, it was for 9% pay raises every year. Say they get 4% pay raises above their existing raises that are baked in. Say they just get 4%. That's $120 million extra costs every single year on top of the $400 million deficit. That is one of more than 700 discrete demands. So, like, in a sense, none of this is like real. It's sort of just a messaging opportunity. And one of the big things they were talking about was the fact that CPS needs to apply for more grants, or the CTU needs to work with them more on grants. In talking with CPS officials, they'll tell you, we apply for every single grant. Many of the examples that they're bringing up are things like tax credits, where we have to spend more money and then we get tax credits back. Or like, yeah, we got 50 electric buses, but for free, quote unquote, from the federal government, but we have to install these chargers and that costs millions of dollars. So I think it's largely an unserious exercise, unfortunately.
I was kind of wondering if almost the volume of the proposals in the contract plus these open bargaining sessions almost seem to be taking attention away from some of the more controversial proposals that maybe otherwise people would fixate on if there weren't so many that it seems kind of overwhelming to even think about it.
What do you think about when you think about controversial things, Kate?
The size of the pay raises, the minimum 9% cost of living, and that's just a floor. So that's kind of a lot. Then when you add on things like expecting CTU to be getting into the level of micromanagement of telling the city how to do affordable housing and who to give it to, who to be giving rental subsidies to. You know, things like that are just great. I'd love to see all our schools be carbon neutral. But what does that mean when we're talking about a lot of buildings that are probably old enough that to retrofit them to make them carbon neutral would be just a gigantic waste of money? On the flip side, let me say, I was listening to you yesterday, John, and I completely agree. Every school needs to be air conditioned.
Yeah, and better air conditioned, and not just a window unit in a classroom.
I don't know that every single building has to have central air. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do it. They could have space packs. I know plenty of people
that works.
Who fitted houses with
That's
space
cool.
packs instead
That's cool.
of doing central
yeah.
air, for instance.
Yeah.
When we've got quite a few older buildings that probably are not going to be around long enough to make sense to do the installation of central air, I don't think they should be getting stuck on that. But they should all have a form of working decent air conditioning,
yeah.
no doubt about it.
Well, so I'm going to walk my wife into every classroom in the CPS system, because Brenda does not live well when the temperature is not comfortable. And she'll be the arbiter. You know, I mean, because I don't care how you do it. I don't care if it's blocks of ice and a fan. It has to be cool enough that the students can study and learn. And
yeah,
I think
absolutely.
In some of those classes, and including the library, and in some of those places, I don't think it is.
Yeah, for one thing, my husband taught in a third floor classroom for several years with no air conditioning. And June, as we are seeing this week, can be kind of hot. Kids get out of school a little earlier now. They used to go almost through the whole month of June, which was just deadly in those non-air-conditioned classrooms. But I actually, Kate, when you said this overwhelming number of proposals obfuscate some things.
Well, I'm wondering if it does, Marge. I'm not going to make an absolute categorical statement that they purposely came up with such a gigantic number of proposals, but I have to kind of wonder.
Well, I was thinking about it in a similar way, in that it obfuscates some really good ideas that ought to get more attention, like the air conditioning, like staffing in the schools. Staffing in the schools, I don't think the general public has an idea of how inadequate school budgets are. And yeah, Austin, if they get another raise, it's going to be even worse. But how do you not give teachers raises, not 9%, but something every year, and to keep up with inflation, which is nearly 20% right now.
Well, I think there are raises in there, just not at the
inflation isn't 20%.
Well, they'll ask right? for a higher percent okay. than they expect to get.
Marge, did you say inflation is 20%?
Oh, I'm not the economist. I just read that figure.
Where? So, I mean, nationally, the inflation rate's around 4%, right?
I'll have to look again.
I think that's cumulative over the last 3 years, and I think that's adjusted CPI. So I think
yes.
Look at CPI 3 years ago versus today. It's up 19%. Now the top line that keeps getting reported is usually an annual or like year
sure.
to date.
I wonder what number is most germane. This is something that comes up a lot on the radio and on our business reporting. I guess you got to include the 9% hump in the camel's back that we had a couple of years ago because it's cumulative. So 3% plus 4% plus 9% plus 4% over the last 4 years, and suddenly you've got 19%. But I mean, of course, things are more expensive year over year. But 3 or 4% is a manageable number for people, and I don't know what a reasonable number for, say, a four-year index is supposed to be. I'm a little out of my league here, but I mean, I know that things are more expensive now than they used to be, but they always are. That's what things are. A loaf of bread costs more now than it did 20 years ago, too.
CEOs are making billions more than they did 4 years ago, and that's not normal. And that contributes to the price of goods. It's not entirely separate. They call it greedflation. Price of cereal can come down if the General Mills CEO wasn't making $20 million over what he made last year. I'll have to look up the exact number, but whether it's the oil companies or the grocery providers or car manufacturers, those CEOs are making insane,
You think that a leading cause of inflation is CEO compensation?
Absolutely.
I don't. I think it's larger economic factors than the ridiculous amount that one person gets at a company. I presume we all absorb those costs.
Corporate greed is
one person and the shareholder.
I'm not saying it's not, but I think the economic forces are much larger than the pay package for one person.
One person plus the shareholders, what they deliver to shareholders as opposed to consumers. It's corporate greed as a whole.
I'm not in favor of corporate greed, for the record. But Austin, can you help me here at all?
Matt, yes. So Matt Iglesias, who was a Vox writer for a long time, he has a great Substack called Slow Boring. He has an article that I have to return to every couple of years called Greedflation is Fake. And I totally think he's correct. And the main reason that greedflation is fake is because it presumes that greed is somehow a variable in economics rather than a constant. Like the CEOs of 2019, they weren't 50% less greedy than the CEOs in 2024. So I think it's often used as a messaging tool, but I don't think it's actually a big economic contributor to inflation. And I think with regard to teacher salaries, I think this is tough and we could do a better job explaining this to folks too. But the way that pay structures work right now in Chicago public schools is that by working an extra year, you go up another step. So you get an automatic raise by working an extra year. If you work 10 years in CPS, you get paid more than if you work 9 years. If you get a master's degree, you get into what's called another lane. So a person with 10 years experience without a master's gets paid less than 10 years experience.
I'm okay with that.
People already get raises every year in Chicago public schools. And then just the final thing on the bargaining, really the lead message from CTU and the mayor has been on transparency. And I got a FOIA request back from the city this week on this very issue. And I asked for emails between the mayor's deputy mayor of education, Jen Johnson, who was formerly chief of staff for the Chicago Teachers Union, emails between her and the three top CTU officials. And the city said, we are not giving you these emails because there's 500 plus of them, 1,200 plus pages of them, and it would be unduly burdensome for us to give you these emails. And I just find that shocking when their lead message really is that we're being transparent and doing this out in the open in a way that's never been done.
What are you fishing for? What are you looking for, Austin? What are you up to?
The influence of a third party who is unelected on city government. And what's funny is by refusing to give me those emails, they're proving my point, which is that there's voluminous communication. There's 1,200 pages of communication between CTU and the deputy mayor of education. So I think there's lots of public interest in that. I got more calls and texts from Chicago journalists after that yesterday than anything I've done in the last 2 years, because people are like, this is FOIA, this is public records. Here's people to talk to if you want to get those. So that was encouraging, at least.
One of the things that bothered me most was you guys said in the Illinois General Assembly's last legislative session, CTU opposed a bill requiring school districts with 300 or more students to post a list of learning materials and activities that were used for student instruction in the previous school year, like titles and authors of textbooks and that sort of thing. Teachers should just be able to override what a recommended, say, textbook was and use whatever materials they preferred and without disclosing that to the parents. That surprised me. And I were I a CPS parent, I would not like that.
I don't think we want to get into that place that a lot of red states have, where somehow there's an idea that parents can choose a curriculum more intelligently or knowledgeably than educators.
Mm-hmm. It should not be
not where I want to go.
Though.
No,
it should not be secret from parents. Nothing.
And I don't know how it could
nothing
be,
in my
really.
Estimation should be kept from parents. They should be able to see what the kids' curriculum is.
A little quick self plug here. I interviewed Mayor Brandon Johnson, and we talk about the CTU and the upcoming contract negotiations, and how is he going to negotiate a contract when they ain't got no money to give. You can hear the full interview on WCIU.com. You can watch it on the block on Thursday at 7 and read a full transcript at the Block Club Chicago website.
Tell us how is he going to pay with no money?
Did he tell you? That's the core problem.
You'll have to listen in to find the answer.
No, come on now. Well, put it this way. Put it this way. Does he see a revenue stream? Is he going to cut costs? Is he going to borrow the money? I mean, it's a math problem.
Ultimately, it's a math problem, but he seems to think it's a math problem that can be overcome. Listen to his answer and dissect from there.
The state is supposed to provide the majority of funding. There's a phrase, it's not quite that, right? But the balance of funding, more funding should come from the state for schools in statewide, not just in Chicago. And then do you do that based on false budgets, or do you do that based on actual budgets and then say this is what we need and go back to the state to get the balance that the city deserves? One mayor after another has tried a version of that, not overly successful, although incrementally and otherwise, funds increased significantly when Rahm was mayor and Forrest Claypool was head of the schools, and he had a showdown and threatened court action, and he got more money from the state. So that's one answer. Go back to the state, which is not giving its fair share.
Well, Chicago is apparently receiving about $1 billion less than what they're saying that we should get according to this new formula for school funding. We're not the most underfunded school district. If I remember correctly, we were like down like number 10, 11, or 12. So there are quite a few school districts less well-funded from the state than we are right now.
I would like to throw in one thing, because you asked me a question I didn't expect. I'm shocked that you don't credit greedflation on corporate profits. I direct you to Fortune magazine, which has an interactive chart and a study that shows corporate profits drove 53% of inflation during the second and third quarters of 23, and more than one third since the start of the pandemic, based on an analysis of Commerce Department data. It's a jump from four decades before the pandemic, when profits drove just 11% of price growth. It's real, John.
You call that corporate profits, but how do you define that? I mean, I don't mind a company being profitable, but I read you to say that it was the CEO pay that was driving
it's
that.
It's the combination of CEO pay and shareholder return. That's what corporate profits have grown, have ballooned, and on some of the very products that are driving household poverty or struggles like gasoline and groceries.
But if the profitability of a company is something that my retirement fund is benefiting from, then I'm not sure I'm entirely against that either, right? I mean, I'm happy to see the value of companies go up, Kate. That's not a bad thing, is it?
Are you talking to me?
I said Kate. Okay. I'm sorry.
Because you did accidentally call Marge.
I know.
Early.
I don't know what the hell is my problem.
I thought this conversation was between you two. I'm not even.
It is.
Wait,
Marge. Am I thinking of the wrong thing here, Marge?
If you want to think about your personal investment portfolio, you know, you're entitled to do that. But you can afford to pay $8 for a box of Cheerios. There are a lot of families that cannot, for whom our stock portfolios don't help them one bit. And the point is, what's the limit? If that's 53% of inflation, are those corporate profits really necessary? And is that where our money should go? Because all our money, right?
We're talking
about a lot of priorities for money right now. And I just don't think that kind of corporate growth is benefiting anybody but those shareholders and CEOs.
I know that. And I wasn't thinking about my retirement someday. But I think Americans want to retire, and we want them to do. We want them to invest in the stock market. And what does that mean? It's the value of those companies. We want those companies to be profitable. We want the value of those shares to go up. That's how you retire someday, in theory. Not, you know, more people than not don't have 401ks, but I mean, that's what we've all been asked to do. So I'm not anti value of these companies going up or the cost of a share going up.
Question is how much? When you give us the statistic that families of color have zero wealth. So corporate profits to help them make investments, it doesn't mean anything to them. What they need is
What do you want Kellogg's to do then?
I want them to maintain viable prices.
By selling cornflakes for less?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Okay, but then I'm not going to invest in that company so much. I'm going to invest in the cornflake company that is going to promise me the highest return on my investment. That's just the way it works.
We used to work with more regulations on corporate profits,
okay.
And it's possible to do that again so that there's no cornflake company that can out-gouge Kellogg's.
Well, Marge is speaking to, we've seen this recently, Target, I think, announced they were going to have some items at cheaper prices now to accommodate for, the tough squeeze on pocketbooks. I think another company recently said they're going to lower some prices too. If they can lower prices now, why couldn't they earlier? The thing is, the price raising up and staying the way it is isn't just because of inflation. A lot of it is also corporations just saying, "Oh no, we're just going to keep it up." That's just the reality. I mean, they don't need to sell cornflakes for $2 more at this point, especially with the numbers going down, as we've acknowledged from Joe Biden's administration, for inflation. The cost of goods has gone down. They just want to keep the price up because people are usually going to have to pay for it out of necessity.
I disagree with the panel on this one, really.
I'm not an economist at all.
If there's a profit to be made selling cornflakes for $2 less than the other guy, there's going to be 500 people chomping at the bit trying to sell cornflakes at less money. And the fact remains that greed is not a variable in our economy. It's not like people are way more greedy now than before. And we see this exact same negative, horrible cycle in a lot of really struggling socialist economies like Venezuela and Cuba, where high prices, rather than blaming poor monetary or fiscal policies, they blame these evil corporate greedy people. So we have to have price controls so that the corporate barons are not gouging us. And it makes things worse and worse and worse and worse. So I think it's a straw man argument.
Well, selling lemonade on the side of the corner for 50 cents, but I could also sell it for a dollar, I think I would sell it for a dollar rather than sell it for 50 cents. And I don't think I would feel bad about that if I had customers willing to pay me a dollar, Brandon.
True, but you don't, then don't blame inflation for this.
Blame Biden for it.
Don't blame the economy. Yeah, don't blame Biden. Don't blame the economy. Mm-hmm. Don't blame inflation. Mm-hmm. You just wanted to raise the price. That's fine. It's competitive market, but that's what we're talking about ultimately.
We got 8 minutes left before you and Austin have to go. I think we can do this next little topic in about 8 minutes. And ladies, if you'll stay with us, whatever your names are, for just a couple more minutes, I want to talk about some of the national topics.
We've looked so much alike.
I don't know what my problem is, but then again, it's not new. Here we go again, because the Chicago Sky takes on the Indiana Fever again this Sunday. So we'll have Angel Reese guarding Caitlin Clark again in their last game this past Sunday. Good old Caitlin Clark was going in for a layup, and good old Angel Reese right behind her, just like in their college days, fouls her in a play that I thought was a flagrant one, and eventually they called it a flagrant one. She clocked her in the head. I don't even think Angel Reese had a chance to get to the basketball, and she knew it, but she thought, how convenient. I can go for the ball, wink, wink, and now I can slug her in the head, and she did. That is the persona of our team right now, and I'm not even sure that's a horrible thing. You want to be the Bruisers? You want to be the Oakland Raiders or the Detroit Pistons of the WNBA? You can, and it seems to me like that's the lane they've chosen.
I definitely think this is a team that's embraced a physical identity, embraced a Bruiser identity, and I think that's something that we usually value in basketball teams. I hear so many people wax poetic here in the city of Chicago about, oh, the 90s NBA, back when they clotheslined you, back when they hit you. Oh, that's when basketball was better. And LeBron, that's why he's never going to be the GOAT. He didn't have to get hit. I don't think Angel Reese was intending to hit Caitlin Clark. I think it was clear that she was going for the ball and just missed. And anyone that's played even just pickup basketball knows you're going to have some moments where you're going to swipe somebody on accident. You're going to hit somebody on accident, missing or whatever. I've had a broken foot playing pickup. I've had elbows to the ribs. And it's not malicious. It's just the way it goes when bodies are flying.
It's just a coincidence, huh, that Angel Reese clocked Caitlin Clark in the head in a play that her hand didn't come anywhere near the basketball. That was a coincidence, right, Brandon?
Coincidence, sure. I think it's a basketball play. It's just how basketball works sometimes. I truly believe that. It wasn't like a Draymond Green play. Draymond Green be doing some stuff where it's like, oh, come on, man. You swinging. You threw a fist.
Yeah.
You know, this is a little different to me. If you look at the video again, I want everyone to go back, look at the video. Angel Reese's eyes stay up and pointed and directed toward the ball, and that's where her hands are going. She just missed. That's really what it came down to for me, and Caitlin Clark was at the other end of the hand.
Well, I don't think that the world should stop as a result of this foul. That is, I think you're right. That's the nature of the game. That was if not a basketball play, it was a shot to the head. I mean, it was called a flagrant one, but that happens. It happens in the NBA. It happens in the WNBA. So I'm kind of okay with it in that that's the way these physical games get played. But I think we can also call it what it was. I think they're going after Caitlin Clark. It was Rick Tellender's piece in the Sun-Times where he just said the ladies in the WNBA don't get it. They don't realize what a valuable commodity Caitlin Clark is. And the Chicago Sky's play against her is evidence of that.
Are you sure it isn't just that Caitlin Clark is under the basket? Brandon makes a pretty good case for that from where I sit, which is not in a particularly knowledgeable seat.
Right. Well, she's driving the lane. And it doesn't help that she is small compared to the other women in the WNBA. She needs to put on some muscle.
Yeah, I think it's odd to criticize them for not sufficiently recognizing that Caitlin Clark is like a jewel of the league, because I feel like the Chicago Sky has generated more press around Caitlin Clark than probably any other team or entity in the last like 3 months. I think it's odd that there's this sort of like paternalistic thing about Caitlin. Like there's one little league dad who's always like, don't you touch my Johnny. Like, don't rough him up like that. Everybody's Caitlin Clark. That's the dynamic. Like, you can't talk to her. Get your hands off of Caitlin Clark. And, you know, stars in every single sport get roughed up. If you're Lionel Messi and you're, you know, the new hot phenom, like you're so good that the other team needs to rough you up. That's part of the strategy. So, and that's part of the strategy in the NBA.
Is it jealousy a little bit on the other part of the parts of the other players?
I think if they're trying to win. So how do you win? Like make it a game as physical as possible for the best player on the other team. And it's like that in every sport.
I'm going to tell you exactly what it is, John, because I will acknowledge I do think there is a targeting of Caitlin Clark a little bit at times, which I think you can trace any rookie, NFL, NBA. They're going to get a welcome to the league. The Caitlin Clark entered a WNBA, a league that is a activist heavy, message heavy league, that is black women dominant, LGBT dominant, and is very proactive on social causes. And Caitlin Clark, with her new wave of fans coming in, has brought in a lot of folks, not all of them, but a lot of folks who are spewing racism, misogyny toward the black women in the league. Angel Reese has been harassed nonstop and called every other name that you could imagine that you can't say on this podcast. And at the end of the day, Caitlin Clark, when she's asked about it, and until about a week or two ago, would just be like, oh, you know, I just don't pay attention to the noise. I don't see it. I'm not on social media. And for so many in the league, black women in particular, it felt like her silence was a statement in itself of saying basically, you know what, I'm okay with it. Especially when she had relatives, her brother, and I believe her boyfriend, people, Twitter users spotted them liking racist tweets about Angel Reese and other players. And when Caitlin Clark is addressed about it, she just deflects.
Wait a minute, she's taking the high road. She's been taking the high road.
She recently, finally, after being called out about it, you know, said there's no place for this, there's no place for hate and all this type of stuff. But that was 2 hours after she was asked a similar question and she deflected to, I don't pay attention to it, and she got called out for it. So I think ultimately there is frustration and resentment going on within the league that Caitlin Clark, there's other white basketball players in the WNBA who are proactive and make it clear, I don't stand for racism, I don't stand for hatred, misogyny in my name. It took Caitlin Clark so long to just say that simple thing, and that's what rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. That's part of what's happening too, is like, she just came into a league where they want to make it clear, we do not stand for that. And Caitlin Clark, she's learning. She gotta make it clear that she doesn't either.
She's got to get out in front of that more than she was. I didn't realize that was an issue she was being criticized for not responding to. I thought the fact that she wasn't calling out the cheap fouls and simply saying that's a basketball play and I'm going to root for the women on the women's team that I didn't get selected to. Every opportunity I think she's had to comment about her treatment, I think she has been non-combative. Yeah. I applaud her for that.
She's been great. She's been the adult in the room most of the time. Absolutely.
Amen to that. You and Austin got to go. It's past your bedtime, so I'll let you guys. I'm not kicking you out, Dan. But I want to honor your time schedules. Austin, Brandon, we'll talk to you guys next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
See you guys.
Well, I didn't mean to totally hijack this conversation, but I could give you some links about greedflation that would be helpful, but I didn't mean to hijack the conversation.
You and I went down that path now, didn't we? But you know, the one that really gets me, Marge, is the Walmart, the Walton family. That's one where you just go, oh my God, how many employees at Walmart's are on some form of government subsidy? They're mm-hmm. actually benefiting from the rest of our largesse because the Waltons aren't paying them enough, and the Waltons have billions and billions of dollars in personal wealth. So I've long thought that maybe the salaries of those individuals could expand if those people would just agree to free up some of their money.
I would not disagree. No, no, I would not disagree. You know, the whole corporate thing comes down to how much money is enough? How many billions do you need?
I think that's the fundamental problem with the conversation I'm having with you. How much money is enough? If we're talking about the Waltons, okay, I get it. That seems to be nutso. But I think if I'm making $100,000 a year and I want to make $150,000 a year by charging more for my stuff, it's none of your business how much money I want or need. It's a capitalistic system. I'm going to make as much money as I can. And some people can afford it and some people can't. But I don't think that's a wrong thing. This is from SCOTUS blog. The Supreme Court on Friday struck down a rule that banned bump stocks issued by the Trump administration after a 2017 mass shooting at a concert in Las Vegas. By a 6-3 vote, the justices rejected the federal government's argument that rifles equipped with bump stocks are or become machine guns, which are generally prohibited under federal law. In an opinion by Justice Clarence Thomas, the court's conservative justices emphasized that Congress could have enacted a law that banned all weapons capable of high rates of fire. Congress has not been able to do so. And I remember one of the justices said something like, well, what's the difference between a machine gun and somebody just pulling the trigger real fast over and over and over and over again? Not that a human being could mimic the action of a machine gun, but the rapid fire is something that people can accomplish with or without a bump stock. So how is it that a bump stock should suddenly be regarded as something illegal? I thought that the logic by the conservatives on this was positively tortured. And was it Elena Kagan or Sotomayor who said something like, it walks like a duck, it talks like a duck, it's a machine gun already?
Talk about your activist judges. There's six of them on the Supreme Court right now. So you can't be surprised by that ruling, but it's nonsensical. I agree with you. So the bump stock allows a gun. It converts a gun so it can fire more than 900 rounds in a minute. And I would like Thomas to identify anyone who has a trigger finger that's that fast. It's a machine gun. Ask any of the families of the victims, ask any shooter whether they think they could just do that themselves. They don't think so. That's why they have the bump stocks. Interestingly to me, this is something that Trump did.
Yeah.
And so why isn't he rallying Republicans now to pass this bill? Instead, we had it stopped. Schumer did try to get it through the Senate immediately after the ruling, and it was stopped, if you want unanimous consent or immediate, to get it through right away without hearings. Any one senator can stop it. In this case, it was Pete Ricketts from Nebraska. But I would like to see Trump stand up and say, yeah, what he said before, we don't need it. Thomas put himself in knots in order to come up with that, just as Alito did in the Roe v. Wade ruling, right? He went back to the 1800s to try to justify what it is that they want to do as conservatives. That's the Supreme Court that we have right now. And if Donald Trump is reelected, he'll have two more slots to fill, a lot of people think. This is the direction the Supreme Court's in, and it's bad. We need some reform on the Supreme Court level.
The only upside is that if they keep coming out with these kind of truly nonsensical rulings, because yes, anyone could tell you that no one can with their finger shoot as fast with a rifle as somebody with a machine gun. But if they keep coming up with these, and maybe this one is a prime example to overhaul the Supreme Court, to get term limits. I think term limits are probably the way to go, and some really enforceable ethics.
Independently developed ethics that they need to abide by. I would love to see that. Yeah, my favorite way to expand the court is to build more representation in the Senate with statehood with D.C. And Puerto Rico if they want it, which is not clear whether they do.
I would caution you on that, Marge, because you feel that way because you think you're going to get two Democrats out of it, but you have no idea what will go on with population in D.C., and it could easily flip the other direction. Rather than add on more tiny areas with overrepresentation in the Senate, we would be better served, I think, to try and fix that disparity.
Regardless of the outcome, like Marge is doing it, if Marge is doing it because she wants another Democrat, it almost doesn't matter if Marge's motivation is, no, those people deserve representation. That's what you're suggesting. In the Senate you're talking about.
Yeah, because right now Congress overrules laws that their local mayor and city council set just because they have part-time residences in that city.
While I do think they deserve representation, I don't think that we should be adding on another small place with overrepresentation in the Senate. So really what we should be doing is annexing them for purposes of representation into one of the adjoining states.
Overrepresentation. I don't know what that means.
Wyoming, they have a bigger population than states who already have senators.
But that's what I'm saying. We're still adding on to the problem that we already have, which is giving two senators to a place that, okay, how many people are in Washington, D.C.? It's more than Montana. It's more than Wyoming, but it's a whole lot less than most other states. So you are continuing to exacerbate that basic problem.
Well, that was the fundamental point about the Senate providing some kind of balance, which is a much bigger issue than we can get into here. But changing the makeup of the court, I'm with you on term limits.
All right, let's do it.
So let me just ask one more thing, and that is about immigration. I thought that if you are a citizen and you marry someone who is not a citizen, that while that person is not therefore a citizen, they are also immune to any problems that would come with their immigration status because now they're married to an American citizen. Evidently, that's not the case. Isn't President Biden trying to do something about that, Marge, right? There was a couple of issues this week.
Yeah, I think the main difference here is that if you you have to still apply for it, and if you are in the country without having gone through a legal process, right now the regulations say that you have to be deported, file for your rights, which it would seem that you would get on the basis of what you just said. It's true. But you have to leave the country to file for it and come back through legally. So that amounts to a deportation order for people. So what Biden is saying, file for it, go through a legal process, but leaving the country makes no sense. You're here, you're contributing, you have family, you're productive residents of this country. Deporting and breaking up families should not be the job of the federal government. So let them apply to be here legally, but stay here during the process.
This is a complete no-brainer. I'm surprised he hesitated to do this by himself before, because I don't think you're going to get a whole lot of people who think that spouses of U.S. citizens are a problem. But and it's a great example of all the arcane problems with crazy regulations in the immigration law that do need to be overhauled. And there are a lot that most people would agree upon, because I think most of the people who are concerned about our border security are not going to have a problem with legalizing or at least allowing spouses to be able to apply for legalization without having to leave the country.
Do people do that? I mean, this is a new subject to me. Do they physically, literally go back to Mexico or Spain or something, and then re-enter the country after having completed the paperwork or something?
But that's why there's like 500,000 people who are living here in this situation. It's a bit of a hardship for some people, of course, to do. And you don't know when you leave how long you're going to have to wait for that process to go through.
Even if you're married to an American going through this song and dance, is that what we're saying, right?
Right. But the problem is that you were here illegally when you got married.
Or without documentation.
They want you to leave and start the process over again.
It also applies to DACA recipients. I heard on the radio this morning someone who had was brought to this country by their parents without documentation when she was 10 months old. And she's grown up here. It's the only country, the only home she's ever known. This is the DACA dreamer thing that Trump actually promised to fix once, the beautiful DACA children or whatever he said. And then he didn't do it. And now Biden is doing it and providing some relief. Obama provided some, and Biden is extending it.
Common sense thing to do. Yeah.
Has Dick Durbin lost his enthusiasm for the DACA cause? I haven't seen or heard a lot from him lately on this topic, and this was his baby, no pun intended.
Yes, it was.
This is the easiest thing in the world, it seems to me, to get your head around and go, yeah, that makes sense. And now I've taken more of your time than I want to. The rest of the topics that we didn't get to this week, we will get to next week, and I will stop being so argumentative about tangential points, and it would all go a lot smoother, actually, if you guys would just agree with everything I say.
Or you could just agree with us.
I guess that's an option. person too, isn't it, Marge?
To make that work.
Point Marge Halperin and Kate Plies. Brandon and Austin had to click out. Eric couldn't be with us this week because he's at a very important golfing weekend, I believe, or week with his buddies. So we'll hope that he is shooting par and joining us next week. Ladies, thanks for your time. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pot on you next week. Okay,
all
ladies.
All right, great.
Thanks.
Good much stuff. Fun.
Thanks for your time, girls.
Yeah.
Bye now.
Sure. Thanks for putting up with the debate.
Oh, I'm Kate. That's Marge.
Yeah. Wow. Would you wear signs, name tags?
We could. Well, actually, we have them on our screen, by
the
way.
Now that you mentioned it, you do. It's right there. All right, I'm hanging up on you. Goodbye.
That's all we can
Bye-bye.
Do. Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.